Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know, you have different takes on Pilate, where Pilate's like, this man is innocent, but I will do whatever you tell me to, which is right. Very clearly fiction, because the actual Pilate murdered Jewish citizens in Jerusalem by the handful whenever they annoyed him.
Right.
So the notion that they would get together and be like, we're going to tell on you, and he was like, okay, I'll do what you want, is just not historical. Hey, everybody, I'm Dan McClellan.
And I'm Dan Beecher.
And you are listening to the Data Over Dogma podcast, where we increase public access to the academic study of the Bible and religion and combat the spread of misinformation about the same.
And we do it with enthusiasm.
And with style.
I don't know why I needed to be. Why did I want to just be enthusiastic in that moment? I don't know. I'm excited.
We're trying to cast a wider net for our audience.
That's right. Right.
Yeah, we tried the sound effects a couple of times. It didn't go so well, but
I thought the slide whistle worked. I don't know why you were against it, but fine.
I really like the sound effect, but you know, there's stuff, there's baggage there. So how are things today?
Man, it's good. We are fast approaching, or depending on when you hear this. Recently passed Holy Week. We're trying to record this in a timely manner to make sure that it appears sometime around Easter.
Yes,
and that's a fun time for a lot of folks.
The most beloved of holidays for many Christians around the world, although most of them don't call it Easter. But maybe we'll talk about that one.
Well, we talked about it a year ago, if you'll recall.
Did we talk about it?
Oh, we talked about Pesach and
Pesach. There you go.
And the fact that it's Passover. Anyway, here's the thing about Easter. I find it very confusing. As a child, I always found it very confusing because there was joy and candy and fun and bunnies. And a murder, a really important, horrific, painful, awful murder.
State violence. Yeah, state-sanctioned violence.
Which felt incongruous to me. Mm-hmm. I don't know about the rest of you all, but...
I didn't know the word incongruous when I was a kid celebrating Easter. But,
No, I'm imposing that one on...
Okay.
I don't think that I knew that one either. but we're going to, so at the beginning of this episode, we're going to talk about Holy Week, sort of what happened, the timeline. Do the Gospels maybe, do they not quite agree on a few things, and how does that work? And then you're going to talk about resurrection, and not just Jesus's resurrection, but just the concept as a whole.
Yeah, where did this thing come from? How is it being worked into the Gospels? And yeah, we're going to get into it. Probably the most controversial episode that we'll ever have. Regarding the, I'm being sarcastic. Just because, the notion that the Gospels conflict on their timeline for the final week of Jesus' life probably shouldn't surprise anyone who has ever heard our voices before. But
let's get into it. I'm going to call, we'll just call this a chapter and verse as we dive into this. So, here's the thing. When I started to do some research about Holy Week and wanted a timeline, I just wanted to sort of understand the basic timeline and try to keep straight what each of the Gospels was doing.
Right.
All of the timelines that I found were on apologetic websites that didn't seem to think that there were ever any conflicts, and it was all very easy to track. And then those same websites would be like, of course, you know, the skeptics will say that blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah conflict, but that's not true because of all of our, you know, all of X, Y, and Z apologetics. Mm-hmm. So what I decided to do was actually go to the website that they were most often citing as what the skeptics would say, which is the Skeptics Annotated Bible.
Okay.
And even I caught them out on a couple of things that seemed like a bit of a stretch in terms of their contradictions, but mm-hmm. some of them seem like important contradictions. So my thinking is we'll go through the timeline and I'll bring a couple things up as we go that might be contradictions, or you can. And we start basically, don't we, with a story we've already told, which is Jesus riding two donkeys into Jerusalem.
Right. Whether this was one on top of the other, whether Jesus was doing the
pyramid,
old Zorro.
Has quickly become my favorite of the
yeah,
other
that's
two.
It's going to be canon pretty soon. I mean, once Zack Snyder gets a hold of it, that's going to be canon. So we'll have some lens flares. We'll have Jesus on two donkeys. So
I like it.
And that is the triumphal entry.
Which, by the way, it sounded like you were, but you weren't just swearing under your breath. Because it sounds, because if you mutter, Jesus on two donkeys, that doesn't necessarily sound, that is what, you were just talking about that. You weren't.
Yeah. So, in Disney movies, it will be cheese on two donkeys.
Yeah, like, exactly. Or whatever.
Well, I don't know if you ever watched the Princess and the Frog. But there's one part where one of the characters is like getting upset and storms out of a church, and she goes, cheese and crackers. And I was like, that's like one of the most like transparent substitutions for what's considered profanity I've ever heard in a Disney movie.
somebody writing out, working on the script for that went to BYU. That's all I'm saying. Okay.
I want to go just before the triumphal entry, though, because awesome. we already have something that is a bit incongruous.
Oh, okay.
Or incongruous, if you're nasty. At the beginning of John 12, we have Jesus arriving in Bethany. Now, one thing to note about the difference between John and the Synoptics is Jesus' ministry is 1 year in the Synoptics. He's up in Galilee. He's you've got the evangelical triangle, these three main cities that he's operating within, and then it's kind of the on the way to Jerusalem, road trip, and then he's in Jerusalem, and that's the last week, and then that's it. John actually has what seems to be a 3-year ministry, and John has Jesus arriving in Jerusalem and cleansing the temple. In chapter 2, like right after the wedding in Cana, he goes down to Jerusalem to cleanse the temple.
Remind us quickly what the order that we think the Gospels were written in. John was the last one, right?
Well, it depends on where you put Luke, because Mark is almost universally agreed to be the earliest gospel.
Right.
It's the shortest. It's the one that doesn't include some of the things that seem to be expansions and innovations on the story that we find in Matthew and Luke, like the birth narrative. It's the one that doesn't even seem to have a post-resurrection story at all. We have one that's tacked on later. And then it's probably Matthew. Luke was probably written after Matthew and is reliant, some scholars think is reliant to some degree on Matthew as well as on Mark. We talked a little bit with Helen Bond about the possibility that Luke might be early second century, that it might have been written after John. But most people put John somewhere in the mid-90s CE, so almost at the very end of the first century CE.
And why is John considered separate from the Synoptic Gospels?
Because the narrative is so different. Synoptic, see together, you can line up the three Synoptic Gospels, and there's a lot of the narrative and a lot of the sayings are parallel. Or if they're not parallel, the same things are found in other parts of the narrative. So it seems clear that Matthew and Luke are reliant on Mark.
Right.
They also share things that are not in Mark. And so this is where the idea of Q comes from. That Q, which is the a reference to the German word Quelle, which means source, is this other source that was not used by Mark that Matthew and Luke are sharing. And then Matthew and Luke also have their own stories that are not in Mark and are not shared between each other. And scholars will refer to Matthew's independent source as M, and they'll refer to Luke's independent source as L. Okay. So there's a complex relationship of all these things to each other. Right. But probably Mark, Matthew, and then either Luke and John, or John then Luke. So okay. It depends.
Okay, got it. All right. So we are. So John has Jesus in Jerusalem way before the other guys.
Yeah, he gets baptized. So it's like, I got to hit this wedding, and then Moses on down to Jerusalem and cleanses the temple, and this is first year of his ministry, and he's going to be going back and forth between Jerusalem and Galilee a couple of times. But in John chapter 12, he shows up in Bethany for his third trip to Jerusalem, and then he is anointed before the triumphal entry.
Oh, okay.
All the other anointings take place after the triumphal entry.
The anointing is a woman putting oil on his feet. Is that the thing, or am I thinking of something else?
Yeah, we actually have a couple of different things where, here what we have is somebody named Mary. Jesus is in Bethany. He's in Lazarus's house, which is different from the synoptics as well, because in those he's in the house of some dude named Simon. And Mary shows up. And she's got a pound of this expensive ointment. Spike nerd, I think, is what it's how it's translated in.
That
the,
is my favorite thing in the universe.
Yeah,
spike
in
nerd.
And we usually translate anoint, but the Greek verb is not the normal verb for anoint there. So it's more like just cleaning or perfuming his feet, and wipes his feet with her hair.
Right.
And this is, and there are a few different things that are going on here. Because one, his feet have not been washed. She's just dumping this oil on his feet and then wiping the oil off. So it's almost like, let me get that for you. Let me just wipe that off. Okay, you should be good to go. And there's a parallel here between Mary kind of washing Jesus's feet with this expensive nard.
Gotta get some good spike nard in there.
Yeah. Sorry, I keep thinking of Monster Squad. Wolfman's got nards. And then later in the next chapter, Jesus is going to wash the feet of his disciples.
Right.
And so you've got Jesus's feet don't need to be washed because he's already pure. He's not sinful. But this is taking the place of the anointing that that happens later on in the other Gospels.
If I remember correctly, when we spoke to Elizabeth Schrader Pulser many moons ago, mm-hmm. she said that her theory is that that the Mary that does all of this is Mary Magdalene. Is that right?
I don't remember if we talked about John 12.
I think we did.
Okay.
In Lazarus's house. I think she was claiming, she was saying that her research says that it could be that was Mary Magdalene.
Yeah. I think I remember that. There is now in Luke, you have this, let me pull up, the chapter happens in, Luke 7, I believe it is. He's eating a woman in the city, which was a sinner. Having learned that he was eating in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster jar of ointment. She stood behind him at his feet, weeping, and began to bathe his feet with her tears and to dry them with her hair, kissing his feet and anointing them with ointment. And again, that's a different word for anoint. And what's interesting here is that sinful woman is not identified. It's not
right.
Mary. But the beginning of chapter 8, it's going to talk about Mary as a woman out of whom Jesus cast seven devils. But this is actually where we get the idea that Mary Magdalene was a sex worker.
Right.
Because we have Ephraim the Syrian in the 4th century who conflates the two. And then Pope Gregory the Great in 591 CE gives this homily says that In fact, I think I have exactly what he said. Yeah, she whom Luke calls the sinful woman, whom John calls Mary. Mm. So Gregory is conflating Luke 7 with John 12. We believe to be Mary from whom seven devils were ejected according to Mark. So now we're taking the unnamed woman in Luke 7, the Mary who anoints Jesus' feet in John 12, and then the Mary from whom Jesus cast seven devils is Mary Magdalene from Mark, and I think is also mentioned in Luke 8. And what did these seven devils signify, if not all the vices? It is clear, brothers, that the woman previously used the unguent to perfume her flesh in forbidden acts.
Oh, what she, wow.
What she therefore displayed more scandalously, she was now offering to God in a more praiseworthy manner. So,
When you have one vial of ointment or unction or whatever,
you got a pound of it. You got
to use it for all the purposes. You got. If it's your lube, it's also the thing that you wash your Savior's feet with. It's fine.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's keep going with the story here.
With the story,
we got a whole week to get through.
Oh gosh. That's
we're not going to get through all of it, but there will be other Easters, guys. We'll get back to it.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
So so that brings us to the triumphal entry, and we've already gone through some of the differences with the triumphal entry, but this happens on Sunday, and this is Palm Sunday.
Right.
So why do we call it Palm Sunday? Well, because they were waving palm fronds, palm branches, in celebration of the triumphal entry of their king, who was just sitting on his ass.
Honey, honey, he's coming. Go get some leaves.
That's an old Brian Regan bit. Get some leaves.
I don't know that. All right. Okay. So he makes it in, and now we have another timeline issue.
Mm-hmm.
You said that John cleansed the temple. John had him cleansing the temple way back in chapter 2.
Right.
Now we've got Luke saying that basically not having any time between the triumphal entry and the cleansing of the temple.
Yeah, it seems like Luke comes into the city, and then he's like, and you know, he made his way over to the temple, and then he starts beating people,
flipping tables, and
gently letting the birds go. But
yeah, exactly.
I'm here to set some birds free and to kick some ass, and I'm all out of birds.
That's
so,
right.
And according to Luke, that seems to happen on Sunday. He's not being very clear. Right. In fact, right after the cleansing of the temple, it just says like, and he was in the temple a bunch, and not being clear about what day these things are happening.
But definitely makes it sound like it's that day.
Yeah, yeah. There's no narrative break. It's just he's a triumphal entry. He makes his way to the temple, and then he drives out the money changers. The other two synoptic authors, however, explicitly put this on the next day.
Right. So he cleanses the temple. That's a good day.
And the cursing of the fig tree also is something that is not in Luke.
That's
right.
It is
in Matthew and Mark, and I don't know if that has something to do with why they put it on the next day, but that's something.
Yeah, that's right. That's another thing that we talked about on an earlier episode.
Yeah.
So great.
Oh, and also home base here seems to be Bethany.
Okay. So that's just outside of Jerusalem?
So
or
yeah,
is it inside.
It's outside of the city. So on the east side of Jerusalem, you got this valley, the Kidron Valley, and then you have the Mount of Olives. Right. And the Mount of Olives is pretty big. And if you go up kind of the middle to the south end of the Mount of Olives and keep going east, kind of on the back slope of the Mount of Olives, you've got Bethany. And so right. he's just outside the city, or as what did the comedian say who talked about the fig tree? Like when you fly into a place, you just stay at the Ramada by the airport. You don't go downtown to stay. So so Bethany is where he returns to,
right?
In the evenings, and that is, I believe, across all four Gospels. John has him arriving in Bethany, staying with Lazarus. And the others have him in Bethany, spending the night with Simon, I think. So on Tuesday, we also have what most folks refer to as temple controversies, but we also have what's called the Olivet Discourse on the return to Bethany. So they're heading back to the hotel, and Jesus is talking about the second coming, basically. And this is in the three synoptic Gospels. And this is where we get the Son of Man will be like this. There's one standing in the field, one will be taken, one will be left. Son of Man coming in the clouds of glory and all that imagery.
Okay.
But this is not in John. John has another spot where he sprinkles some discourse in, which I think is funny. It's actually after the Last Supper. But Jesus is, you know, they finish the Last Supper and he goes, well, let's get out of here. And then there are three chapters of Jesus lecturing them. And then, so that's like the, I think it's the end of chapter 14. It's he says, arise, let us go. And then it's not until chapter 18 that it's like, so they arose and they left.
Well, listen, if I was facing down what Jesus was facing down at that time, I'd probably dawdle a little bit myself. Yeah.
So a lot of scholars think that the discourse in there, which includes the intercessory prayer, was added or moved from another part of John or something like that.
Okay.
So we do have, you know, the four Gospels don't always agree on when things happen, but it sounds like even John couldn't agree on when things were happening. Things were getting moved around. On Wednesday, Jesus continues to teach in the temple. The temple is kind of, you know, he spends the night in Bethany, but during the day he's in the temple dropping knowledge. And there we also get reports that now the Sanhedrin, the bad guys, are like, Jesus is in town. We need to exploit this opportunity.
Well, and every time he goes to the temple, he's just raising a ruckus. He's causing trouble. So,
and here's something that I brought up on some social media site recently that annoyed a lot of people, and it's something I've said before on TikTok. The reconstruction of the historical Jesus doesn't really have a role for the Sanhedrin in Jesus's death. It was probably the Romans who were like, somebody came in and drove a bunch of people out of the temple and started a small riot. Well, kill that guy. That's probably not all that went into
it. That's called disturbing the peace. That
right.
is not legal.
And this is the biggest festival celebration of the year in this giant city, capital city, where the Romans are always struggling to keep the peace. And so if anything put Jesus on the Romans' radar, it was making a whip and driving a bunch of people out of the Jewish temple and starting a small riot. And so from a critical historical Jesus point of view, that was probably what got him killed.
Right.
Now, when the gospel authors get a hold of it, you get this kind of trajectory from Mark, where, you know, the Jewish leaders are involved, all the way to John, where it was like Satan entered into them and they were all trying to plot, how are we going to get this Jesus killed? And you know, you have different takes on Pilate, where Pilate's like, this man is innocent, but I will do whatever you tell me to, which is right. Very clearly fiction, because the actual Pilate murdered Jewish citizens in Jerusalem by the handful whenever they annoyed him.
Right.
So the notion that they would get together and be like, we're going to tell on you, and he was like, okay, I'll do what you want, is just not historical.
Right.
And so it seems like the role of the Jewish leaders in this, and up to and including the notion that they all cried out with one voice saying, his blood will be on us.
Right.
That's all fiction.
Right.
That is something that they made up to shift the blame to the Jewish people and off of the people who were probably actually responsible for his death, the Romanes, called Romans.
When you say they did this to shift the blame, you're talking about mm-hmm. the authors of the Gospels?
Yeah, and well, probably... This probably originated before they were actually committed to text, but the people okay. who are curating the tradition, either as it was circulating orally or who were committing it to writing in the sources that may have been used by Mark and the other gospel authors.
But, was this? Do scholars believe that the reason to shift that blame from the Romans to the Jews was just as a means of separating Christianity, this new cult, from its Jewish roots? Was it, or why would they do that?
Not so much. I think probably part of it had to do with growing hostility between Jesus followers within Judaism and the rest of the movement. Probably some of it had to do with the fact that they were trying to get by in a Roman world. And so we're trying
so it's a bad look to be like, look, the Romans killed your God or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there were other rhetorical points to make about the Jewish folks who rejected their savior.
Right.
That have kind of an anti-Semitic tinge to them.
Yeah.
And I a wonderful book I think that discusses this to some degree is Bart Ehrman's book, Jesus Before the Gospels, which uses social memory to talk about how the presentation of Jesus's life and death in the Gospels could be serving certain interests within kind of the social memory of what happened. What is likely a gist memory versus what has been altered in order to serve the rhetorical goals of the authors and the communities.
Okay.
So yeah, that's something that is probably a literary creation is the Sanhedrin sitting there plotting, how are we going to get Jesus murdered? But
okay.
But that starts on Wednesday, according to that was their hump Wednesday. Wednesday into Thursday, we're making preparations for the Passover, and then we have the Last Supper, which is in ye old upper room. And if you go to Jerusalem today, there's even a medieval-style upper room that they will take you through, and a lot of space in there. It would have been a pretty happening Last Supper if that's where it had actually happened. We have...
And the Last Supper itself was a Passover
right.
Seder.
It would have been...
Meal.
It would have been a Passover meal, but the way they would have done it in the first century CE is not perfectly clear to us.
Right.
But the way it's done today is quite different.
Right.
So it, you know, they didn't have a little matzah that they were passing around under the table to the kids to hide and right. and this kind of thing. Those are much later developed traditions. But yeah, it would have been a traditional Passover meal. And then we have within the Synoptic Gospels, they're in Jerusalem. they go out, probably skirt around the south side of Jerusalem to go down the hill into the Kidron Valley and come up the other side to the western slope of the Mount of Olives to what is known as the Garden of Gethsemane, which refers to an oil press. And so these are olive trees that, that make up this garden. And we have Jesus praying in the Garden of Gethsemane. We don't have this this prayer in John. Some people think that the intercessory prayer is kind of the Johannine substitute for the prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane.
Okay.
At which point, Jesus is arrested in the garden, which is something that is precipitated by the betrayal by Judas. And another interesting trajectory is with Judas. There's a theory that in Mark, there's not a presentation of Judas as a conniving backstabber.
Mm.
It says that he turned Jesus over, but the handed over verb is kind of morally neutral. Like it's not a negative, it's not inherently negative. And there's a theory that Judas had done this in the hopes that he would be setting up the confrontation that would catalyze Jesus's, you know, hulking out and destroying the Romans. And then after he saw, oh no, that didn't work, he is distraught because he could have been trying to arrange the meeting to kick off the second coming. And it's in Matthew, Luke, and then John where Judas is increasingly possessed by the devil to do this. So it's an interesting trajectory to see as Judas
so
starts.
So Mark doesn't have him get paid for it. Mark doesn't have any of that stuff. Is that right?
There's definitely not. They don't mention Judas going and picking up money like we have in Matthew and in Luke / Acts.
Okay.
So yeah, it is something that he just it's just kind of like, and then Judas did this, and
like, they're like, "Hey, who's Jesus?" And he's like, "He's that guy." Oh, it's that one. Not necessarily a mwahaha sort of.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And there have been some interesting stories of that brings up. There's one of the things that Jesus says on this last night. In Luke, we have him say, you know, I sent you out without purse or script and you guys did all right, right? And they're like, yeah, we did fine. And then he says, well, now sell what you have and buy swords. Do you recall something in that area? And I've seen people recently appeal to that scripture as an indication that Christians need to be warriors.
Yeah.
You know, we got to go strapped.
It's the Jordan Peterson school of Christianity.
School of meekness, yeah.
Yes.
But what happens is he says because he's to be numbered among the criminals or words to that effect. And then his followers say, "Hey, we got two swords right here." And he goes, "That'll do." And it's kind of a weird head scratcher there, but then when he gets caught in the Garden of Gethsemane, they're there with the swords.
Right.
And so
one dude loses an ear. One poor guy loses an ear.
Oh, yeah, Malchus. And the idea seems to be that if he's going to be counted among the criminals, let's have him have these guys with their unauthorized weapons on them when the Roman authorities show up to pinch him.
Mm.
And so it's not saying
to what end? I'm not sure I understand what the purpose of that would
be. So there's that prophecy. He will be counted among the transgressors or the criminals or something like that.
Oh, okay.
And so the idea is, that fulfills that prophecy that when the Romans show up, and it seems like an afterthought because, you know, it never really says, you know, it's not like they try to fight off the Romans apart from just the ear thing. One guy
he's
gets
like,
Van
hey,
Goed,
you guys remember that prophecy? You better get swords. We don't want people to be confused.
And so that's the one passage people will appeal to. Like, see, Jesus is cool with us having AKs. But it's actually just Jesus saying, hey, we got to fulfill a prophecy. Make sure you got a sword laying around.
Wow.
So, right. And there are scholars who will say, oh, well, the disciples misunderstood. They didn't know what he was talking about with the swords. And Jesus was just like, you know what? Let's just drop it. Yeah. But I think that's historicizing the text a little bit too much. But that brings us to yon trial.
Ah, yes.
Did you have any questions leading up to this?
No, should I? Now I feel like I'm supposed to. let's talk about the trial. I mean, so we've got, start us in with what happens.
Okay. Broad strokes. We have a few different people that Jesus goes before, and these are different according to the different gospels, because we have Annas, who I believe is the father-in-law of Caiaphas. He used to be the high priest. So in John, he comes before Annas, then he goes before Caiaphas and part of the Sanhedrin, and then later comes back before the Sanhedrin and then goes to Pilate. According to, I think it's Luke, Pilate sends him to Herod, who then sends him back to Pilate. It
all happens in one day.
Yeah, well, and it starts in like the middle of the night, so you can imagine somebody was like getting woken up and be like, I have to put on my robe and go out and to see this guy. We have Pilate interrogating him. And this is something that Bart Ehrman also points out in his book. There's in some of the accounts, Pilate like brings Jesus out to the crowd and he's like, this guy, you want me to kill this guy? And then he like takes him back in and then sentences him. And then he goes off and is crucified. And where did we get the account of everything that Pilate and Jesus said in their little private meeting?
Right.
In his office before he went off to get crucified, because none of the disciples were anywhere near any of that, and there was no opportunity for Jesus to tell any of this story.
You haven't read Pilate's authorized biography?
they're actually they're in the late 19th century, and I've got to remember the name of this book. There were some people who published what they called the Acts of Pilate.
Oh,
which they claimed were firsthand accounts of Pilate, but they were, they were very clearly 19th century compositions,
right?
And they're also strangely white supremacist, like because one of them's like
he said, shocking no one.
Yeah, one of them describes Jesus's appearance. And it's like he saw them and you know, he had flowing golden hair and blue eyes and lighter colored skin. And then all the Jewish people around him were swarthy with dark hair. And,
right.
You know, he's this Aryan Adonis.
Right.
And it's just straight up white supremacist. But you have some of those in the late 19th century, and every now and then on social media, you will have people trot out those accounts and be like, "See, we have accounts of what Jesus looked like."
All right, let's push through. We're already threatening our final. We might not be able to make it to our.
A bit about resurrection as we get to the resurrection in the.
Sure. The thing. So he's pronounced guilty. We figured that out.
Yeah.
And sent away to the thing. And meanwhile, we've got Peter denying him along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some question as to the number of cock crowings and
whether it's just once or three times.
Right. Fine. let's keep going.
There's a big discrepancy, however, in regarding when Jesus is crucified.
Okay.
Because the Synoptic Gospels describe him being crucified at 9, and then it says around noon, the sun went dark. And then around 3 p.m., that is when Jesus says, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, and all that kind of stuff. So we have a several hour crucifixion. And in John, it actually says that they lead him out and crucify him at noon. So they are off by a handful of hours.
And that's, that's a significant difference. It's not, it's not a game changer, but it does. I mean, if the sun, you know, if we've got moments like the sun going dark at noon, it does seem like it's important to sort of keep some of these together.
Yeah. And then I've seen apologetic attempts to try to identify accounts from later Roman authors who were like, there was an eclipse this year. And they're like, that's the year that Jesus was crucified. And it's like, well, there cannot be an eclipse at the Passover because the Passover is when the moon is on the other side of the earth from the sun.
Right.
So you can't really have an eclipse at that time. So
interesting. Okay.
And also eclipses don't last for 3 hours.
Yours
max
don't.
7 minutes. Didn't you say yours don't?
Yours don't, according to you. They had better eclipses back then.
I've been practicing.
Some of us love history. Others used to or never did because history was presented as nothing but the rote memorization of names, dates, and facts. Basically, the story got left out, and that made history kind of suck. My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a university professor with a PhD in history, and bringing history to life is my passion. That's why I created my podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. I want to teach you everything you need to know about U.S. history, but I do so through stories. Let me tell you about George Washington begging his men not to mutiny against Congress, Clara Barton saving Union soldiers amid enemy fire, enslaved Frederick Douglass risking his life for liberty, and about so many other figures as their real experiences make industrialization, social movements, and even congressional debates and tax policy come to life. Subscribe to History That Doesn't Suck today, and join me, Professor Greg Jackson, every other week for a new episode, where I'd like to tell you a story.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Can we just briefly take a brief moment to talk about what the soldiers gave Jesus to drink?
Yeah, let's talk about that. We have the accounts are different.
Yes.
Mark is the earliest, and I would say since this account is found in all the Gospels, they're probably drawing from Mark or from whatever source Mark was drawing from. But Mark is our earliest, and it just says somebody filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a stick, and gave it to him to drink, saying, let's see if Elijah will come to take him down. And then...
I've got wine mingled with myrrh. Is that just a
what James? Translation are we looking at? Hang on just a moment. Let me pull up the Greek. Okay, so... So we got a sponge... And we got sour wine / vinegar.
Huh.
Let me look up this word here.
So I have
sour wine or wine vinegar is what it has in Mark.
In Mark. Okay.
Yes. Now let's Matthew 27:48.
So, okay.
And that one has, I believe it has the same thing.
vinegar to drink. So this says now, okay, so I don't know what translation these guys are looking at. I'm gonna guess that we're in the KJV.
Oh, let me take a look. Filled it with vinegar. That's what it has for Matthew 27:48 in the KJV.
I've got, oh, I'm looking at Matthew 27:34. Gave him vinegar.
Oh, they gave him vinegar to drink mingled with gall. Yeah.
Which doesn't sound very nice.
No. And that, but that just says, that has enon or enos, which is just wine. That's just the generic word for wine.
So that's weird.
Wine mixed with gall. But that's not the the stick one.
Right.
Which gets interesting. And then we've got John 19:29. And this is the, of all the Gospels, John is the least likely to be historical.
Okay.
It's writing the furthest away, maybe. It is also the one that's toying with things the most and seems to be based on entirely different sources.
But also seems like the one that's best written. Like it's most interestingly written.
Yeah.
It's like telling a much better story, but yeah. Probably it's storytelling, like more than the other things.
And there we've got put a sponge full of oxos, so that sour wine again, on put it on hyssop.
What's hyssop? I don't know what hyssop is.
It's a type of branch.
Okay.
It's type of fly, it's like a bush branch. And gave it to him to drink. And I've heard people say that this sounds like the xylospongium or the tersorium. And for folks who have visited ancient Roman cities, not anciently, but have visited them today, they have, you have the latrines, the public shared bathrooms.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a little trough that kind of runs right in front of you. So if you're sitting down, it's down by your toes.
Oh.
And the xylospongium would be a sponge that was on the end of a stick. And you would take that stick and you'd splash it around in the water. And then you would clean yourself with it. And
yikes.
So there have been people who are arguing that this is what's going on.
That they gave him a poo stick?
That they gave him a poo stick. And not the kind you throw under the bridge and then run to the other side of the bridge.
Not a
you heard that right when the words came out. You were like, that sounds like Winnie the Pooh.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So yeah, there's an argument for that, but that doesn't make much sense to me. Particularly because of how the story changes and some people say, well, they put vinegar on it to aid in, you know, antiseptic, whatever, but it's wine, it's sour wine or
no matter what, they were just trying to give him something gross as a last, as a sort of rude last thing, an insult.
Yeah. And,
It almost doesn't matter if it was poo or if it was like nasty vinegar wine or whatever. It's like you don't want to drink it. That's the
Yeah. They're just making his final moments unpleasant.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then he gives up the ghost. We have the Aramaic Eli Eli lama sabachthani.
My God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?
Yeah.
Which he doesn't say in all of the Gospels, right?
I think it's in most of them, but probably not all of them. Yeah. Cause I think in, cause the John, I don't think wants to have Jesus asking God why, he has been forsaken. Cause for John, Jesus is the Word. They're united, in will and agency and all this kind of stuff. So you can't have that, high Christological, Jesus going like, what's happening? So,
why didn't you save me, Dad?
So after he's received the vinegar, Jesus says it is finished, which, in the Greek is, tetelestai.
Okay.
And it is done and gives up the ghost.
And then, either he ascends to heaven, or he goes to hell, or what happens to him in this moment? Because there's a lot of different stuff that can happen.
Yeah, we've got a story. It's reflected in Peter and elsewhere that he went to preach to the spirits in prison, and this could be part of the harrowing of hell, where Jesus descends into the underworld, to the abode of the dead, and you know, frees the captives. It could be, if it is appealing to the Enochic tradition, it could be talking about the people who were in the days of Noah, and it could even be talking about angels potentially, because right. In the Enochic tradition, the angels are bound in the deep, dark places of the earth. This is Jesus going down and basically making possible the salvation of the folks who died before Jesus's ministry.
And this is so this is after he dies, but before his resurrection.
Yeah.
So Peter has him going to the spirits in prison.
Right.
Luke has him. Verily I say unto thee, today shalt thou be with me in paradise, he says to one of the other guys hanging with him.
Right.
Which one would imagine means he's going to heaven? Question mark? What is that?
Yeah, we still don't have systematic ideas of what heaven and hell are like yet. That's something that gets developed after the New Testament is completed. But he says paradise here, and interestingly, you brought this up before we started recording, and we verified that this is the translation in the Septuagint of the Garden of Eden, the Paradise of Eden is what we have there. And so the idea could be something that didn't really make it into the later systematization of the concept of heaven. I don't think we do the author of Luke any justice to try to take that concept and then work it into all the other concepts of heaven that are expressed by all the other New Testament authors, and then kind of whittled down into something usable by early Christians. So
yeah,
this could
but they're
be
using the same this word paradise here is used in other places as sort of a heaven stand in place.
Word. At least it's a better situation than the bad place.
Better than here. Better than. I don't know where you're going, but you can't stay here.
Can't stay here. Yep.
Let's see, and then. But then there's also another concept, which is in John, who says after he comes back, touch me not, for I am not yet ascended to my Father, but go to my brethren. So
yeah,
in that case, he just stuck around.
and that could. It could fit with the harrowing of hell that Jesus spent the one day and two nights at the all expenses paid trip to the underworld.
Right.
Or it could just mean I haven't ascended to my Father in bodily form yet. There's been a lot of debate about what on earth this means that she can't. Does it mean don't touch me? Does it mean don't grab me? Does it mean don't hold on permanently to me? You got to let me go. It's unclear from the text what exactly is going on, but there have been a lot of different attempts to explain that.
Yeah, you said something in the middle of that I think we need to touch on, which is how many days and nights was Jesus?
Yeah.
Because it... You hear the number three tossed around a lot, and yet it wasn't three.
No, well, I mean,
or was it?
He so according to at least the synoptics, he gives up the ghost around 3 p.m. John doesn't really say exactly when he gives up the ghost, I don't think, but that is before nightfall. So that is
3
still
p.m. on Friday.
Friday, right? So. He dies on Friday before nightfall. The day starts at nightfall within the Jewish tradition.
Okay.
So Friday night would have been part of Saturday.
Okay.
So so we have a full day. There is a full 24-hour period where he's gone, but he's only gone for a part of Friday, all of Saturday, and then a part of Sunday, because they come to the tomb early Sunday morning, right, and he's already gone.
That's a day and a half.
If we're going by 24-hour periods, yeah, it's a day and a half. Now, you know, if I fly to, like, I was on Monday, I flew to Kansas.
Right.
And then I was in Kansas all day on Tuesday, and I flew home Wednesday evening. And so I would say, you know, if I said I spent 3 days in Kansas, now would it be like, hey, you spent 56 hours in Kansas. That's not 3 days. But, you know, I might be like, I was there for a day.
Right.
Like either of those.
It took up three of my days, essentially. Right. Now,
there is a problem with this, though. And that is that Jesus says, this adulterous generation will get no sign from me, no sign, except for the sign of Jonah. And it says, just as Jonah was in the belly of the great fish for 3 days and three nights, so will the Son of Man be in the heart of the earth for 3 days and three nights.
Okay.
So
that is a problem.
Yeah. So that's where, you know, that's... How did you almost get the days right? I have approximate knowledge of many things. Some people will recognize that quote. But yeah, it's good enough prophecy, because it absolutely was not three nights.
Right.
Yeah, that's
okay.
Black and white.
Well, and now we're at the point of talking about resurrection. So let's dive in quickly to... resurrection as a concept. Where did this idea come from?
We don't really have anything. Well, we don't have much in the Hebrew Bible that could plausibly be connected with resurrection. We don't have anything that explicitly talks about a physical resurrection. In the earlier periods, once you die, your body was put in a tomb. And then once everything had gone except for the bones, your bones would be collected up. And in earlier periods, they would just be thrown in a deeper part of the tomb, and you would just become one of the ancestors, this mountain of bones, where you were indistinguishable and disarticulated. Right. Or you were put in an ossuary, a bone box, and had a name written on it, or not. And that was stuck in a smaller part of the tomb. There was no expectation of resurrection. Until we, probably because of the Greco-Roman period, we have ideas about reward and punishment in the afterlife developing. We probably have in that period ideas about resurrection. We have some hints in Daniel. We have Ezekiel, the Valley of the Dry Bones. You know, the flesh comes back to them. And this is really about the restoration of the nation of Israel. But this is probably fodder for the development of a concept of resurrection. We have it mentioned in 2 Maccabees 7, which is probably a mid to late 2nd century BCE text, where it mentions the mother and the seven sons, and that they were because they were righteous, they were looking forward to a better resurrection, but because Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes was wicked, he's going to be destroyed. So in an earlier period, it seems like resurrection was the reward, no resurrection was the punishment.
Right, annihilation. Like,
yeah, annihilationism. Once we get to the New Testament, there seem to be three different concepts of post-mortem punishment. Annihilationism, temporary conscious torment followed by annihilationism, or eternal conscious torment. And we see those kind of sprinkled around the New Testament. Although Paul never refers to any of them explicitly, never refers to hell at all. Hmm. Although does once and a half refer to people being destroyed. So might be annihilationism. But we have this this concept of resurrection that is developing within Greco-Roman period Judaism. And it seems to be represented a couple different ways in the New Testament. And you also have people being brought back to life in the Hebrew Bible and elsewhere.
Okay.
But there's not a sense of you're immortal now. Right. It's you were dead. Oop, okay, we're going to hit the reset button.
You get a few more weeks, buddy.
Yeah, you're still mortal. You're still going to get old and die. There are some folks who argue that the idea of the dying and rising God, the kind of cyclical go down to the underworld, come back thing might have influenced the idea of resurrection. But it's something that's developing in the century or two prior to the New Testament. And then we have Jesus is the one who kind of kicks off the resurrection, except in Matthew, because when Jesus dies, tombs open and people rise up.
Right.
And
there's
just
like
kind
a,
of
there's
make,
like a little, it's a dead man's party. Who could ask for more?
A little mini zombie apocalypse where and it says that people were seen in the city and
yeah, they're just wandering around the streets. It's fine. Don't worry about it. It's cool.
Yeah. And nothing that we don't hear anything about whether they were now immortal, if this was because Jesus is supposed to be the first fruits of the resurrection, the first person to be resurrected. So maybe it was just like, hey, you know, a what was the Pixar movie Onward? Maybe it was just a you got 24 hours kind of deal. And but yeah, so the resurrection is kind of unclear, but it's crystallizing by the time of the New Testament, and it's in the periods following that that we get, along with the systematization of heaven, of hell, and of these other things. And I think it's important to note that the gospel authors, the other New Testament authors, they're mostly writing from their own point of view, and they have different ideas about all of this stuff. But what makes it necessary to consolidate it all, reconcile it all, harmonize it all, is when the New Testament comes together and now we have one corpus and we're considering it a single corpus, which is something that starts in the second century and is really formalized in the fourth and fifth century. And now that we're looking at it all as inspired scripture, suddenly it's like, well, let's make sense of it all. And we have the apologists in the second century who are trying to make the gospel intellectually palatable for the Greco-Roman elite, the intelligentsia. And so they're looking at this corpus like, this is a mess. We gotta get this organized. And that catalyzes this work of systematizing everything and taking all these disparate kind of incongruous pieces and trying to fit them together to make a single kind of systematic framework that can work. And that's what's going on between the second and like the fourth and fifth centuries within Christianity. And that's why we have the ideas that we have now. It's not because, you know, Matthew and Luke and Paul and John and James were all like, we agree on everything.
Right.
Because they didn't. They disagreed on a ton of stuff. But then you have Clement and Athanasius and Tertullian and all these other guys who are looking back and saying, well, if we think these people were all inspired, then we got to make them agree.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a necessity that drove the development of the concepts as we have them now. But in the New Testament, they all have different ideas about the resurrection, about postmortem divine punishment, about all of these things.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, that'll do it for the show. I think for our after party for our patrons, we should go through a few more of the contradictions in the story, and we'll chat a bit about that. So, if you want to become a patron who can actually hear that after party and hear bonus recordings of every week, you can join us over on Patreon.com/DataOverDogma. Which we would really appreciate you. The $10 a month and up category is what will get you the after party. But also you can just join us there for an ad-free version of every show and early access to every show. If you'd like to reach out to us, you can always do that. contact@dataoverdogmapod.com is the way to do that. And we'll see you next week.
Bye, everybody.
Data Over Dogma is a member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. It is a production of Data Over Dogma Media, LLC, copyright 2023, all rights reserved.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. and they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
What's something you learned in history class that you feel like wasn't the whole truth? Better yet, what's something you didn't learn at all that was omitted completely? That's what I like to call redacted history. My name is Andre White, the host of the Redacted History Podcast, the place where history's forgotten events, heroes, and villains get their story told, one episode at a time. The Redacted History Podcast. Real history never dies. Stream the Redacted History Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts.